push the mic. I have an introduction to make. This is always one of the high points of a state convention. Somebody said the two high points at a convention, and I think it applies at national and state, are the presidential report and the keynote banquet address. Carl Jacobson, of course, has been our president for 9 years. He has been our leader, and he's given every year he's given a presidential report in which he's detailed the activities of the organization over that past year. On Mindy's and my urging, he's going to do something a little different this year. Carl has been on the National Board of Directors of the National Federation of the Blind since 2004, and one of the responsibilities that Dr. Maurer has asked him, as he asks all the National Board members and one or two other people from time to time, is to attend conventions in other state affiliates and serve as the national representative to that convention. We have a national representative here, Barry Wunder, and he'll be up right after Carl. Carl has, of course, at those conventions, had the responsibility of delivering a keynote address, and he's developed a keynote address that has really become very popular. He's attended conventions in, Missouri, Montana, Virginia, Maryland, Hawaii, and he's got another one next week. I went to Maryland last year. I heard about the speech, and so I went to the Maryland convention last year because I wanted to hear it. Mindy's heard it 4 or 5 times and still enjoys it as much as she did the first time, and I'm sure that some other people, I know that Gary has heard it at least once and probably somebody else has, but we thought it'd be a great idea if Carl, if people in this affiliate, since Carl's never going to be the national representative in this affiliate, because you don't do it at your own affiliate, it would be a good idea if all of us here have the chance to hear this presentation. So Mindy and I urged Carl, it didn't take too much urging, to give this presentation, and I now am proud to present my friend and the president of the National Federation of the Blind of New York State, Carl Jacobson.
Yesterday, when I was young.
The sound bites are getting more creative all the time.
You let me have it.
I thank Ray for those kind words. And one of the reasons I wanted to do is because I wanted to reflect with everyone at this affiliate a little bit about my own point of view, about who we are and why we are, and just what's been going on in my head for a while. And I wanted to talk to us for a while this morning about freedom. And freedom is something that we talk about a lot. It's been written about a lot. It's something that people have striven for freedom through countless generations and centuries. People have died to secure freedom, and people have different ideas about what freedom is and what freedom ought to be. And we are constantly engaged in that discussion and that strive for freedom, be it here in the United States or be it anywhere else in this world. And people have written about that and informed our beliefs about what freedom ought to be. And back in the 16th century, a British philosopher, a political philosopher named John Locke, put forth some political theories. One of John Locke's political theories I'm sure you're familiar with. John Locke said that governments are created to secure and protect life, liberty, and property. Those were his words. It was later changed by a Virginia property owner to be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think he probably thought that having property was the pursuit of happiness and changed it to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a phrase which we are more familiar with. That came from the writings of John Locke. Among the other writings of John Locke, in a different treatise, he posed the idea of imprisonment and freedom for an individual. And he said that an individual who finds themselves in a room that they believe to be locked and barred is not likely to try to leave that room. They will be so convinced that the room is barred to their exit that they will spend their days and nights and life confined within that room, and that room becomes a jail for them, and they are just as much imprisoned had the doors been actually barred. The doors are not barred, but the person believes they are, and therefore they've given up hope, and they've never tried to exit through those doors and to venture forth to freedom. Freedom, in that sense, had been thought about by a lot of people. And freedom, in many other senses, was thought about through the centuries, and particularly when it comes to blind people, freedom was a goal that we always sought. We always sought the freedom to pursue our own lives, to pursue our own destinies, to pursue our own livelihoods and homes, and get a job and a family. And in 1940, a bunch of blind people came together in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, all of about 17 of them, from just a handful of states, came together to form something they had the nerve to call the National Federation of the Blind. 17 people hardly sounds like a national movement to me. But they believed it was a national movement. They believed they could create a national movement and a national groundswell of blindness to secure freedom for the blind. And that organization grew. That organization grew through the early 40s, the mid-40s, into the 50s, and continued on to grow. And while that organization was growing, life was going on in America. And life was going on for many individuals and individual families and peoples throughout our country. And there was a young couple in Brooklyn, New York, the gentleman of which had just returned from the Second World War, and a young woman, immigrant from Scotland. The gentleman, young man was from Norway and had just served in the Second World War, and the lady was from Scotland. And they had met and known each other prior to the war and after the war. And following World War II, they got married and began a family. And they hoped for a better life, and they hoped for wonderful children, and they got me and my brother, but they did the best they could, having gotten what they got. So came around this world sometime during the Harry Truman administration, and we'll hear from one of Harry Truman's native sons later, but came around during that time, and grew up pretty much like any other kids, with the product of immigrant parents in New York City. And life was going on real fine, and went through the usual childhood experiences up until sometime in the very early 1960s, when all of a sudden I wasn't seeing anymore. I wasn't seeing as well as I used to. Things were getting blurry. Things were getting a little darker. Things just weren't making visual sense. A five-letter word had become a two-letter word until you twisted around and stuck the other three letters onto it. It was fading. And so I talked to my mom about that, and we thought we ought to go see some doctor, and I was all of about 15, wasn't really much in charge at that point. But I went and saw some doctors, and the doctors, being very honest, as doctors sometimes can be, not always, told her the truth, that this is irreversible, and the boy is blind, and the boy will remain blind. And that's just the way it's going to be. You are welcome to go pursue other medical advice if you want, but he's blind and he will remain blind. And they gave my folks that information. And perhaps a day or two or three later, I heard from another room, turned out to be my folks' bedroom, heard from another room the sound of crying, the sound of a man crying, which was rather unusual for me, the sound of my father crying because his son was blind, and blindness was a despairing thing. Blindness was a hopeless thing. Blindness meant the end of that boy's life, the boy that my father had hoped would grow up one day. And it made an impact on me because, like I told you before, my dad was from Norway. And I don't know how familiar folks you are with Norwegians, but the saying goes something like, there was a Norwegian once who loved his wife so much that in the heat of passion, he almost told her. Scandinavian folks, by their nature, are not emotional folks. So you hear your dad crying, it makes more of an impact than anybody else crying, because you say, whoa, check that out. Something really hit him. And what hit him was the despair of blindness. But I was 15. You had to do something. how to go somewhere, how to go on with whatever you do when you're a teenager. You go, when you're a teenager, you go to high school. So they found the high school in New York City. Mom found it, I guess, you know, somebody had sent her there. Because again, being of the immigrant background, they were not familiar with the New York City system and the American system for that matter. Rights, they didn't exist. No, there was no IDEA, no real rehab act the way we know it today. But they sent me to a public high school in Brooklyn where they had a place called a Braille office. What's a Braille office? It's a place where they read Braille books, is what they were. Now we call them resource rooms because we don't want to say Braille. Our resource was Braille, and it was a typewriter. And then there was a teacher in that office, a teacher named Sam Ellis. He was the Braille teacher, and the blind kids in that high school would report to that room in the morning, and you'd leave your coat there, you'd meet a reader there occasionally. For your study period, you would do it in that room, because that's where your reader was. If you needed a typewriter, it was in that room. If you needed things Braille, Mr. Ellis was there to Braille them. Mr. Ellis was also there to straighten us out now and again. I might mention Mr. Ellis a little later, or I might mention right now. It depends how the mood hits me. But Mr. Ellis was the kind of guy who would probably be fired today, or at least written up, for inappropriate behavior. Because he would say to us every once in a while, he'd look at one of us sitting in the room and he'd say, "Jimmy, quit rocking. You're making me sick. And I want to give back my lunch when I watch a blind kid rock the way you do. Get your thumbs out of your eyes. Nobody wants to hire a blind kid that makes him sick. You're never going to get a job if you make your boss sick. So cut it out." He said, "If you guys duel with your canes anymore, I'm taking them all away. You can find your way home without them." So you're going to quit dueling with your canes, and you're going to quit rocking. You're going to get your thumbs out of your eyes. And he was just real honest with us. And he sat me down the first day I got there. He said, "Okay, kid, I know you're new. You're blind. It's new for you." He said, "But then again, there's tomorrow, and then the next day, and then it's the next week." He said, we're gonna teach you Braille." He said, "You got about 2 weeks to learn this thing, then you got to practice it because you don't have much time to waste. You're in the middle of high school." I've heard it said that Braille is hard and it's going to take you years to learn it. Sam Ellis said, "You got 2 weeks to do this. Let's get going." I don't remember if I took three because, you know, high school, you try to stall it as long as you can. But it was not a mystery to us. Mr. Ellis was one of those people who read Braille himself. He was a sighted teacher who read Braille. He read it visually. He would often remark, he said, "If I keep doing this, I'm going to be as blind as you kids. I'm going to use my damn hands." But he was literate, and we don't find that anymore. Mr. Ellis told me a lot about blindness. He told me a lot about Braille. He told me a lot about studying. He found a way to get me typing lessons so I could type. That was perhaps one of the more important things I learned in high school, was how to type, to make my thoughts available to the sighted world. So I got those things, but he didn't tell me about the possibilities. He didn't tell me that the door of the room that I found myself in as a blind person was unlocked. He didn't tell me there was a way to freedom. There were about a half a dozen kids in that class. One of them was a young woman named Linda Podell. Linda, I understand, passed away a couple of years ago. And I guess one of the things that I failed to do, and I think we all failed to do that, is say thank you to people before they're gone. Linda was my age, so it was obviously a premature passing, and should have found a way to say thank you. But Linda was in that class when I got there, and we came in by school bus. Now, those of you who are not familiar with the New York City school system, high school kids travel to and from school using public transportation. That's the norm. That's what you're expected to do. Perhaps when you're in the lower grades, you're taken to school either by mom or dad or a school bus. But by the time you're in high school, it's the norm for you to travel on the subway or the bus system to your high school and just come and go daily. Well, not this blind kid. I was blind. I had to ride on a school bus. You put the blind kids on the school bus and you ship them back and forth. And I wound up riding a school bus with first graders. Well, by this time, I'm about 16 or so. And I had been doing this for about three or four months now, getting really tired of this. It's also late, the school bus. And because I had been noticing that each morning in class, in our official room where we reported, Linda would come in with a cane. And she'd come in and hang up her coat, And if there was a reader there for her, she'd work with the reader. Otherwise, she'd pick up her cane and she'd walk out of the room and head off to class. When the end of the day came, she didn't wait for the school bus. She picked up her cane and headed out and got on a bus or a subway and went home. She just came and went from the school on her own. And I said, I can do that. I used to do that. I used to do that when I was in another high school before I went blind. I could do that. So I wondered about doing that. And I said to myself, if Linda could do that, I could do that. And she never said to me, she never talked about orientation and mobility to me. She never talked about that freedom stuff. She never told me either about that door on my room that wasn't locked. She never bothered to tell me that there was a way to freedom. She just walked freely. She just demonstrated freedom. And one day I said to my mom, you know, I need to get one of those canes that the blind kids are using, the blind adults are using, because I don't want to ride on that school bus anymore. And I got the but answers that you usually get from your mom when you tell her you want to do something that she considers dangerous. It's like, Mom, I want to climb a tight wire over Niagara Falls. Mom, I want to go on a subway. Yeah. But. I said, well, look, this is the way it is. I must have been 17. I said, Mom, this is the way it is. I am 17 years old. I can quit school. I don't need your permission. I don't want to quit school, but I can't quit school because I'm not riding school bus any longer with first graders. I'm tired of it. It's embarrassing. It just stinks. I'm not doing it anymore. So I will either get, we either have to find a way to get me one of those canes, or I quit. But she found a way to get me one of those canes. She contacted the Industrial Home for the Blind. It's not called that anymore. It's called Helen Keller Services now. The old Industrial Home for the Blind, she made some calls, and because I just wanted to buy a cane and start walking around the street. I could do that, yeah. Where do you buy one of those things? You know, like, they were $350 at the time, yeah. But I was told you couldn't just buy a cane. It's almost like you needed a license to have a cane. You needed training to have this. I needed training for what? At that time, a 48-inch white stick, you know, this is state of the art. Do your belly button, remember those?
Yes.
You need training to get those things. So anyway, they got me training so I could have this all-important white stick. And they sent what was called then a cane teacher to my home. A cane teacher that they later became called orientation and mobility instructors as the pay scale rose. You can't pay a guy a lot of money and just call him a cane teacher. It has to be a magical profession with a master's degree. This guy said, you know, I'm going to teach you some basic things. And he did. And he came to my house every day after school for a while and started out walking up and down the block, started out crossing some streets. And, you know, this progressed pretty quickly. Started doing the buses and subway routine in New York City. So after he had been with me for a couple of weeks, he told me he thought I was getting pretty much close to the end of his stay with me. He said, I think I've taught you all you need to know. But I tell you what, here's a piece of paper and here's a $5 bill. I want you to go, last time I was here, I put my pants in the dry cleaners. So I want you to go and pick them up and bring them back here, and I'll meet you at your front door. He said, I'll follow you all the way, but I'll meet you at your front door. So go pick up my pants, and here's the money to pay for it. So I said, where's the dry cleaners? And he paused, and he said, you're a smart ass, figure it out. So I've got a piece of paper here. That was before the Kurzweil National Federation of Blind Reader. That was before the Kurzweil machine, period. I think Reagan. That was before Kurzweil almost. So I'm standing there on this street here, and things weren't much different, by the way, in New York City. New York City has always been an immigrant town, and everybody's folks came from somewhere. So I'm walking in the streets, and I got this piece of paper, and I'm walking down the block, and I'm going, excuse me, could you... What's this paper say? Excuse me. Can you read? Oh no. Can you? I finally got somebody to stop and read the address and the name of the cleaners to me, and they told me where it was, told me what the address was, and I stopped and figured out where that would be. Went there and went into the store, picked up his pants, and I walked out with a pair of pants, and I swore I was gonna throw those damn things in the street. I spent his money on them. I was gonna drop them in a puddle right at the curb. But I didn't. I brought them back. I gave them to him. He said, good job, etc., etc. And I'm often asked to tell that story now and again when I meet the gentleman. I meet him annually, and several of us meet him annually. usually the last week in January or the first week in February, down in Washington, D.C. He has an office in the Rayburn Building. It's the Honorable Ed Towns from the 10th Congressional District of Brooklyn. Was at that time a cane teacher in the streets of Brooklyn. He is now a congressman from the streets of Brooklyn. But his legislative director always says, tell that story about when you wanted to throw the boss's pants in the streets. And Mr. Towns, by the way, became a great influence on me. He and Mr. Ellis set those positive attitudes about your mobility. I didn't see Ed Towns again for years and years, and I had moved many times. And this kind of breaks the mold of today. This kind of, I don't know how people figure out we did that. After I saw Ed Towns, I'd gone out to many places and moved, and I never called him back to show me, to say, I just moved, I need orientation and mobility services. I just changed jobs. I need O&M. I just need this. I need O&M. He gave us the basic tools back then to do that, to get from point A to B, or to get to a C. Now the C is new in your life. Or D. Now the D has arisen. But he never told me either that there was freedom beyond the door. He was teaching me how to walk around the room, if you will. He was teaching me how to negotiate that room that I was still trapped in, the room that still contained me. The room where my blindness and my blindness attitudes lived, not the room on the outside of the unlocked door. I continued to live in that locked room. So life continued, but I went on with those basic skills, and I thought I was pretty hot. The cat's meow here. Went off to college, and if you remember those days, it was more fun protesting and partying than it was studying. I was the 60s guys. Free, free, free love, free beer, free war, and the whole thing, free the prisoners, etc., etc. We went on to continue on into my undergrad. And somewhere in my undergrad, I interrupted the undergrad to get married. And most of this affiliate knew Sally. My late wife and I got married in 1967. And got our jobs and continued on. And I got a job, what was going to be then a temporary job in Randolph Shepherd. Sometimes jobs in Randolph Shepherd are never temporary. Sometimes they become temporary long-term careers. and they hit some bumps here and there. Anyway, my first go-around through Randolph Shepherd was at the Morgan Annex Post Office in New York, one of the major facilities, that I wound up becoming what they called in those days the chief operator, which we now call a manager. That was at that time the second largest facility in the city. But prior to becoming that chief operator of that facility, I worked for the gentleman who was the chief operator, a fellow named Norman Decker. We might hear a little bit about Norman later. I worked for him, and I was working for him at the time that we found out that Sally was pregnant, and with our first son. We found out that when she was going to have Brad. Found out that we needed to move from the place that we were living in. The place we were living in was nice, it was our first place. We thought it was nice because it was ours. Remember your first apartments, everybody? You want to go back to your first apartment? No. Nobody wants to go back to your first apartment. This was all of $90 for four rooms, and it had permanent year-round ventilation. It had access to the elements. It also had little visitors, and not the little visitor that Sally was carrying. We weren't waiting for that little visitor. So funny enough, they came under the doors. They came out of the drains. It was hideous. But everybody's been in that apartment. Everybody remembers that apartment. And we decided that we didn't really want to bring our own little critter into that apartment that had its own thousand little critters there. Good enough for us, but not for a baby. So we looked around. And found a real estate agency and went to the real estate agency and I saw a few apartments and we found one that didn't have critters, had heat, had nice landlord, was in the right neighborhood, it was everything, it was close to transportation, just what we wanted. Found a few dollars more, but that was fine. We could live with that. That was good. Put a down payment on the place and went about our way and set about plans to move there. Well, I used to work 3 to 11 in those days, and Sally used to work the 7 to 3 shift at the hospital. We got home, I was at home one day getting ready to leave to go to work in the evening, about 1:30 in the afternoon. Get a call from Sally at the hospital because they called her on the business line at the hospital and said, she said to me, I just got a call from the real estate agency. And they said, we can't have the apartment. I said, oh, what happened? She said, well, they said we can't have the apartment because you're blind. Now this often takes a lot of people back. This was 1968. Mm-hmm. This is pre-discrimination laws. Yeah. This is pre-protections that we enjoy today, that we take so much for granted, that we just expect people can't talk that way to you. They can talk that way to you, no sweat. You can't have that place because you're blind. And I said, no, that's not right. And I said, we got to do something. She said, well, that's what the man said. I said, no, we can't, you know, that's not right. We want that place and we can't stay here. Now, you're pregnant, so we got to get out of here. But the man said, I said, I got to go to work. Let me call Norman and tell him I'm going to be late. So I called the facility where I was working, where I was supposed to be at 3 o'clock. And I said, Norman, I've got a problem. He said, what? He said, let me pause for a second when I talk about Norman here. You remember the show Along the Family?
Yeah.
Remember Archie Bunker? I'm here to tell you folks that Archie was real. Archie was not made up by Norman Lear. I worked for Archie Bunker. When Norman passed away a few years after the show began, he passed away like in the early 1971 or late 70. And All in the Family previewed in January of 71. And I had it on, didn't know what was coming, but I heard Carol O'Connor doing the Archie Bunker, and I got whiplash. I spun around and said, wait, that's Norman in the TV. He's like, you want to know what Norman sounded like? Catch a rerun. Plus, Norman was Archie. Remember, Archie cared. You know, we'll come back to Archie, but Norman sounded just like Archie. So when I talk about Norman, remember Archie. And Norman said to me, he said, what's the matter, kid? I said, this guy says we can't have the apartment that we put our money down on because I'm blind. And I want to see what I can do to maybe get the apartment. He said, you can't do nothing. I said, yeah, but I want to try. He said, you just can't do nothing. He said, I want you to get in here. He says, come to work. I can do it. And then let me get out of here so maybe I can do something for you. So I said, but Norman, what? He said, look, stop arguing with me. Just get into work. I said, all right. So I told Sally I was going to work. Got to work a little before 3, which I was supposed to. He said, okay, what's this guy's phone number? So I told him, and he says, okay, you just do your job. I'm going home. He said, I'll call you later. He said, so time went by, you know, 4, 5, 5:30. A little before 6 o'clock, the phone rings. He says, kid, you just got the apartment. I said, we got what? He said, I said, you just got the apartment. Don't worry about it. He said, what'd you do? He said, never mind what I've done. I said, you just got the apartment. He said, we took care of it. I said, what do you mean you took care of it? What did you do? He said, look, you really want to know? I said, well, I'd really like to. He says, I calls up this real estate guy, and I says to him, how'd you like 20, 30 blind guys picking in your...